Hey everybody, how are you guys doing? I'm Colleen Fabry and this is Venture Europe. Venture Europe is a series of conversations with successful entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem contributors where we discuss about the strategies, tactics, frameworks, and failings that they have used and experienced during their journey. It is my personal vendetta to contribute in making Europe one of the most attractive entrepreneurial ecosystems in the world. Big words, hard work, so let's get started. This episode is brought to you by Vauban, the easiest way to launch and run your venture investing. An all-in-one integrated solution to form syndicates, VC funds, and co-investment SPV programs that are built for the next generation of global venturers. From fundraising to exits, Vauban provides an automated back office that handles the legals, banking, investor onboarding, and administration, which allows their clients to focus on what matters: finding the next unicorn and building investor relationships. Vauban has facilitated over $1 billion of capital invested in companies such as Revolut, Bolt, and Airbnb, among others. Find out why funds like Antimus, Octopus Ventures, and BackVC, just to name a few, are using Vauban by heading to vauban.io. And now, back to our guest. My guest today is Xavier Collins, currently a vice president of Turo, the American unicorn facilitating car sharing. At Turo, he's responsible for launching and building the UK business as well as leading their international expansion. Prior to Turo, he's held roles at Deliveroo and Uber, and most recently founded one of the UK's largest angel investment syndicates. During this episode, we discuss why he left a secure career in law to join Uber, why you usually get what you measure, and how he finally became a singer and a songwriter with an album published on Spotify. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Xavier Collins. Or just entered the room right now. So if you don't mind, I'll have a beer. It has been actually like a long week.
No worries at all. I've actually just had one outside with some friends and come back for this, but I'm on a sparkling water. It's very, very healthy, but at least it's refreshing.
Yeah, I guess that works, just to warm up your voice a little bit.
That's it. I was going to see if I had a beer in the fridge, but I don't have one. So there you go. Water it is.
How come? Like, you're an Aussie. An Aussie not having like a beer in the fridge?
I know, it's terrible. Well, I'm actually half Kiwi, half English, but studied in Australia. So I have the terrible misfortune of having the Australian accent. But no beers in the fridge is a terrible, terrible sign for my Antipodean roots.
Why, unfortunately, you have studied in Australia?
No, not even. I mean, like, unfortunately, I have the Australian accent. I personally don't mind it, but it's just quite a unique accent. But no, I had an amazing time. I lived in Sydney for close to 6 years, and it was just, I think, as a university town, as someone in their early 20s, you can't ask for a better quality of life.
Yeah, actually, one of my best buddies from Oslo, shout out to Phil, he's from Australia. But everyone loves his accent, so I don't know why. In particular, like girls, you know.
I think in America, maybe they seem to like the accent more. I think I've just labored under this challenge, which is, you know, I was born in London. I lived in the UK for the first 7 years. And basically for that time, I had, you know, a quote unquote normal accent. And then I moved to France and I was the palm from the roast beef from England. And then I moved to New Zealand and everyone knew me as the French boy from France. And then I moved to Australia and everyone knew me as the bloody Kiwi. And now I'm back in the UK and everyone thinks I'm this like Australian. So I don't mind the accent, but it's more a feature, I think, of just, it's noticeable. It's being perceived as different, I guess.
So you were always a little bit of an outsider.
That's a great question. Yeah, I think not so much I'd like to say I wasn't an outsider, but I think I definitely had a lot of experience of starting again. And yeah, I guess being new to somewhere and having to like quickly embed. I don't perceive myself as an outsider. Well, you know, I hope I'm not an outsider. I feel with all the places I've lived, I've got like a pretty strong connection. And like when I'm back there, I feel like I can kind of get into the swing of things, even if I'm not a real Aussie, quote unquote, you know, or a real Kiwi, I feel connected to the place and connected to the people.
Got it. So I also left from home when I was 14 and I lived in multiple countries and always like I had to adapt. You know, you feel that you have to adapt. You can't necessarily kind of come be very like straightforward with your point of view. You want to see like also like what other people think and how do you fit like in a grand scheme of things, which I think that kind of helped me a lot to navigate different situation much better than if you have like a very strong point of view, if you lived only in one country.
Totally agree. A very good friend of mine says, hold strong opinions, but hold them loosely, which I think is a great expression. I try and be true to that. I couldn't agree more. I think, honestly, you know exactly what it's like when you have to move around a lot. It sounds really cool to people. Oh, you've lived all these places. I think the other side of it is it is super hard to change so often. But, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world for exactly that reason. And like, I think that it's definitely like empowered me to be able to relate to like lots of like pick up in a new situation and find some kind of common ground or relate to like people, even if I've never been there. You get used to trying to see the commonalities, right? And trying to like find where you agree and where you don't agree and know how to talk to people.
Interesting. And also you have like a quite a interesting background, right? So you studied philosophy and law, and then you kind of moved to the startup ecosystem. And now also you're an angel investor. So I would like to maybe go back with you during the time you studied philosophy and law. How was it different than what you expected or imagined it would turn out?
I still do love philosophy. I haven't read it or studied it in years, but if I ever get the chance to talk about it, I do my best to try and add some value to the conversation. But the truth is, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't really have any preconceived ideas going into it. One of the best things I got told going to university was it's about teaching you how to think. What was great about philosophy and also law is it's like a really useful set of tools or like a framework for understanding how to think and how to solve problems, which has been like, I'd say, incredibly valuable actually in what I went on to do. It's very rare that anything you study at university is that directly relevant to whatever job you do. But I didn't have this idea going in, but what I learned through it was like, wow, there's a pretty interesting way to like unpack problems and strip things back down to first principles and then solve from there. So I kind of loved those elements of both law and philosophy, I guess.
Why law and not mathematics?
I'm terrible at maths. Don't tell the CEO of Turo. But I enjoyed maths when I was a kid. I think that my strong suit is I'm good at understanding things conceptually and I'm good at using language to articulate a solution to a problem. There are people who can use math to basically break down and understand the world around them. And I have untold admiration for them because my brain just doesn't work as efficiently that way. Like I can get by and I do think it's in, like, I think certain elements of like math as it gets into those like kind of, I find it very, very interesting, but it was just never my strong suit. And so I kind of lent into what I was best at.
So after you finished studying law, you had a clerkship at Herbert Smith Freehills. What would a day at work look like?
That's basically, it's like a top tier law firm in Australia and Asia. And it was one of those things where it was like, everyone wanted to get the job at Herbert Smith Freehills at law school. And I went there super excited. I was extremely lucky to get it. And then bought my first ever suit, went to the office thinking I was going to be like an M&A lawyer and I'd watch Suits and I was kind of, I was like, this is it. I've done it. I've made it. And then my day would basically be staring at the clock, waiting for the day to end, pretending I was busy. I can say this now because it's been many, many years. Basically, you know, because you're so junior, you're a clerk. And so they don't want to give you any real work, but you have, they also want to kind of test you a little bit. So your day is kind of spent waiting to get handed the odd bit of, you know, the odd document to read or, you know, mark up or redact information from. And so very kind of basic stuff like that, to be honest, which is funny because you study for 5 years and you learn all these cases and all these principles. And then, you know, your first day of work, you're kind of redacting documents. But that was that experience. But I met some great people, what can I say? And I have a lot of respect. But the people who could stick with it and then go on to the higher echelons of law, ton of respect. Super, super high profession.
What was the motivation to change careers, do something different, and then join Uber?
You can probably hear it in the answer from the last question.
Yeah, exactly.
I think if I had to distill it, I remember sitting in the clerkship and like hearing other clerks brag about, or like, you know, celebrate the fact that they've been invited to a client meeting and they got to meet the client, and the client has asked them a question. And I was, you know, it's pure arrogance, but I was just sitting there and I was like, I want to be the client. Like, why do I have to wait 4 years to just be like the relevant person in the room, or to like just to have a chance to interact with the relevant person in the room? Like, I would love to be that person. So I'd kind of had it in my mind that, you know what, like, I can do more than this, and like, I can go start something, and, you know, maybe, and then, you know, this is lame, but I think it was 7 or 8 years later. I used to look, there was a law firm called Slaughter and May, which was like a top tier law firm in London. I used to Google it when I was at law school in Sydney. And I just remember probably about 2 years ago, I walked into a meeting with a partner at Slaughter and May for a Turo topic, and seeing an associate who had been brought along to the meeting with the notepad. And I had this crazy thing where I was like, oh my God, I've become the client. Now, obviously, I was representing Turo, but that was basically the motivation. It was like, I wanted to do more. And so I had a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends at law school. He was at Uber. He joined super early. And this was Australia back in the day. And they were literally, it was one of the first markets they launched. And they just needed help onboarding drivers and handing out flyers and doing whatever it took. And I just kind of jumped at it. Now, obviously, it was a massive gamble and a massive change from, you know, dressing in a suit and going to a top tier law firm. It just had this amazing feeling about it, and it was super exciting. And, you know, there was a great potential to grow with the business. So, and they were literally just launching UberX. So I was motivated by the idea to kind of have a real impact and do my own thing and become the client, so to speak.
Do you remember the decision in your head? Like, did you do like a pros and cons list? I guess like it's not an easy decision to leave a very secure career path to join like this new startup that just launched in the country.
I mean, so there's actually I don't know if you probably haven't seen it, but there's a third thread to this, which is actually, so I'm the founder of a business called Nexus Notes, which is an education marketplace. It actually still runs today. And I'd set that up at university with a couple of friends, and that was kind of running in the background. It's basically a marketplace that allows university students to publish content relevant to their course and for other students to access it for free. We had actually applied to an accelerator program in Australia called StartMate, which was Australia's kind of YC. You know, these guys, it's the Blackbird team. So they've led the investment in Canva and a bunch of great Australian startups. So it was an amazing, amazing accelerator. And we got in and we got given 50K of funding. And so when I kind of made the move to Uber, it was to learn about startups. But actually in the back of my mind, it was because I wanted to go do my own startup. And so just as the Uber thing was starting, we got the funding on for Nexus. And that's really what drove me to make the big jump. And that was the crazy decision, because I actually left the law firm and the Uber opportunity to go do my own business. And to answer your question, like, no, I did not do a pros and cons. You know, I think if I had of, I would have definitely not left. It was a crazy decision. And maybe even financially not the best one. If I stayed at Uber, I could have done it. If I'd managed to not get fired, I could have done great staying at Uber for the last like 10 years. It was never a question in my mind. I had this itch that needed to be scratched. I wanted to start my own business. I wanted to go for it. And so I guess I did.
Got it. So fast forward 8 years, you also become the general manager for Deliveroo, and now you're the VP of Turo. Looking back, like, how would you describe working in a fast-growing company?
Absolutely exhausting, but also amazing. Like, I love my job. I really mean that when I say it. There's definitely days where it's frustrating or hard, as my team will tell you, but I love my job. I love going to work every day. I love the people I work with. And I've been so fortunate that ever since we took Nexus kind of part-time and stopped pursuing that, and I was lucky enough to join Deliveroo super early and help them build the south of the UK, and then join Turo 4 years ago to help launch, run the UK business. Every single one of those, in both of those jobs, which were crazy, crazy. You know, we scaled so quickly at Deliveroo. From when I joined, it was doing 100 orders a day in the markets I used to run. And when I left 3 years later, it was doing 10,000. That was exhausting and ridiculous and like all encompassing. And Turo is a very, very similar story, but you're having like a real impact. You're building something, you're creating something. You get to work with super smart, passionate people, and you get to love what you do if you're interested in that kind of thing. So I'd say exhausting, but enjoyable.
And how do you get from 100 orders a day to 10,000?
Unbelievable product market fit. I think that was the thing that has struck me. So Turo is an unbelievable business. I think it's going to change the world. It has how people access vehicles. It solves a real problem, but it's been a hard business to grow in that, like, it's a new concept, you know, sharing out your car with a stranger, just like Airbnb was hard to start, but it's been like a slow burn that's turning into a, you know, huge business hitting exponential growth, but it has been a real challenge. Whereas I think what was fascinating about Deliveroo is it's a high frequency product, which means that, like, if you use it, you're using it. Some people use it 3 times a week. You know, I'm sad, ashamed to admit I've done that, but I try and cook more now. If people use it, they use it at least once a month, right? So because it's high frequency, you're not always competing for share of mind or marketing. Like, it just becomes part of people's lives. And as a result, it can just, like, rapidly blow up. And that's because at the time, you know, there was nothing like it. And people used to completely evangelize it. And so we would go to a market in the south of the UK. I remember going to Bournemouth to a freshers fair with the team. And basically we rented an old school Land Rover Defender. We wrapped it in Deliveroo branding and we just had free pizzas. And we just launched in Bournemouth. Like, no one had ever heard of it. And these students kind of came up being like, oh, what is this thing? And, you know, we were like explaining, well, look, you download this app and you can get, you know, Nando's delivered. And you just see their eyes like light up. And then, you know, the next weekend we would be watching the screens and it would have gone from like a couple of orders in the city to all of a sudden, like, there were 100 orders and, like, we didn't have enough drivers and the restaurants are calling us because they're angry because the food was waiting and no one was there to pick it up. And, but, you know, it would just explode. How did that happen? Like, I think there's a million reasons why that happened and a million things we had to solve, but without this, like, crazy product market fit, it never would have happened. And Deliveroo really had that.
And where was the competition back then? Because now I think it's a little bit more competitive.
Super competitive now. To be honest, back then, put it this way, when I was doing it, the competition was just trying to convince a restaurant that we weren't crazy. So I used to go to the restaurant and meet with them and say, hey, you know, work for this business called Deliveroo. It's this really cool idea. You can basically make the most out of your restaurant when you're not busy. You can be sending orders to people at home, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they would turn around and be like, ah, this doesn't sound like a good idea. People won't want to do this. People want to eat in store, or like, I don't want to have this technology in my kitchen. So actually the biggest competition back then was like people's attitudes. But today, obviously Uber Eats, Just Eat, DoorDash in the States, Caviar, there's just so many players, Instacart, so Gorillas and Getir. It's a crazy competitive space because it's a huge market, right? And there's this electric product market fit. So everyone's trying to compete and capture a slice of the pie.
Yeah, I mean, I have, I think, 3 or 4 apps.
There you go,
Uber Eats, Foodpanda, Deliveroo. Yeah, I think they all try to compete on different things, either kind of user experience or prices. Also, I know that you have built one of Europe's biggest syndicates, Shaman List. I was wondering, like, when did you decide to get into angel investing?
So when I decided to get into angel investing back in, it must have been like 2016, obviously, like, I've done the kind of startup cycle, right? So I founded my own business, I'd kind of gone through the accelerator program, met a lot of other startups, seen the whole founder explosions, had it myself, journey, everything. And, oh, not everything, and never had an amazing exit. But I basically had seen a lot of the life cycle because I'd been lucky to work at Uber and Deliveroo. I knew a lot of great people who were all kind of doing their own thing or building companies. And so I kind of had an eye for what makes a good founder, what makes a good idea. You know, I didn't really have, and I still don't have a great understanding of that, but I had enough of like pattern recognition that I felt somewhat confident that I could kind of give it a go. And then there was just a very good friend of mine, a guy called Henry Ludlam, who's the founder of a business called Percent. It's just an API that basically enables companies like Google to pay money to charities and do it in a way that's safe and secure and verified. But when I met him, that wasn't the idea. It was a random app for basically helping sports teams at universities or clubs and societies raise money for their club by where they spent their money at different restaurants. Completely different idea. But he'd set up a festival that we were sponsoring at Deliveroo. He was a super entrepreneurial guy. And he kind of told me about this idea. And I had no money at the time. But I basically said to him, look, whatever you do, like, I'm in. He had like just that, he had that way about him. And I was like, look, I just want to be part of the story and I want to help you if I can. So like, I'm in. I put in, you know, £2,000, which was a lot, still a lot of money, but for at the time was a huge amount of money. But, and on the assumption I would never get anything back. But, you know, luckily that's been one of the best ones I've ever invested in. And they recently just raised, I think, $30 million from General Catalyst at a Series A. And now they're working with Google and Canva and they're doing this whole charity thing. And it has nothing to do with why. So it wasn't like I made a good bet. I think I got into it basically through luck and met Henry, believed in them and just thought, why not? And then that experience kind of got me started and it just kind of rolled from there.
And how many investments have you made to date?
Probably at around 20.
20. So looking back, how do you assess founders and how do you source deals? Did that change? Like during this 20 investments, do you always look for the same type of founder or is there an energy that you kind of feel? Is that a gut instinct that you just know that they will do whatever it takes?
It's totally an energy slash like gut instinct. I think that's a perfect word for it. I assess founders in the same way I hire people. I think I've also been extremely fortunate to work with some of the incredible teams and nothing that personally I've been able to accomplish through the businesses I've worked on could have been done without like the, it all comes like my skill is hiring good people. That is it. And then hopefully motivating them. And I think that I don't know how I hire good people. I think that actually like when I look back at it all, it's always done on like attitude. Do they just have this kind of attitude about them? And they can be inexperienced, they can be young, they can be old, but if they've got this kind of like resilience and drive and that kind of positivity and optimism, I tend to back them. And I think it's the exact, and it, as a result, like I typically, you know, it probably sounds ridiculous, but I typically know within a couple of minutes of meeting someone in an interview, like if I'm gonna want to hire them or even meeting a founder, like am I actually engaged? Do I actually think I should go for this? And so nothing's ever changed on that. It's always been done. The way I like to say it is like, a good founder is like water running downhill. It won't necessarily follow like the most direct path, but it will get to the bottom.
I like that.
I can't remember what the second question was, but that's how I do founders basically.
Yeah, like I was wondering, yeah, like how do you source deals?
I can give a more succinct answer. Basically, just my network. Super lucky to have worked at these great companies. It's full of people who are setting up new ideas. And I've just built a reputation for being able to like help introduce people to other good investors. So I would say 3 to 5 times a week, someone emails me saying, hey, got a friend that's like trying to raise money for this. You know, would you be interested in like, look at this deal? Or do you know anyone who'd be good to speak to? So, you know, I can't always answer them. But as a result of like trying to help people and connect people, it's just this kind of flywheel.
And which geo do you cover?
Geo agnostic. I think, you know, I think the kind of stages I invest, I really don't want to give the impression I'm an excellent investor. I'm really trying to figure this out. So let me just caveat everything with that. But I really am founder-led as a starting point because it's what I understand. And I'm also more industry-led in that like I know a relative amount about marketplace businesses, having worked on a couple of unicorn marketplaces, and they're all the same principles. And I know a bit about mobility and a bit about logistics and so I try and focus on industries where I understand the problems. And if I invest, I can actually have like a positive impact on increasing the likelihood of that company's success. But geo-wise, I mean, I haven't made any investments outside of the UK and the US, but not to say that I wouldn't. It's just that I think that's a function of access.
Got it. I know who to contact now. So let's change gears a little bit. Let's get personal. What was the most challenging period in your career and how did you overcome it?
One was starting a delivery when it was an unknown company and thinking I'd just blown it all by turning down the law firm and Uber. That was definitely very, very hard, but I didn't really do anything to overcome that. I just persisted. The hardest one was when I first started at Turo. I knew nothing about insurance. So Turo is a car sharing marketplace. It basically enables car owners to share out their cars to other people when they're not using it. Now, a fundamental piece of that equation is making sure that any car on a Turo trip is 100% covered alongside the guest who's taking the trip. Trying to convince an old school insurance industry in the UK to take a bet on a crazy American idea like that with zero knowledge of how insurance worked was genuinely, for me, my version of climbing up Mount Everest. I really struggled. It took me many, many months. And I got laughed out of many meetings. I overcame it literally just through never giving up. Is that a basic answer? But I think that is the key. I think it's not a very insightful answer, but the only way is if you believe in it enough, you just can't give up. You just have to keep going. You have to learn why you're getting knocked back. Keep trying to find your angle in, but you've just got to be like super resilient. If you truly believe it can work and you know that deep down, it will work. You just can't give up. Like water on a mountain. You got to get to the bottom. There'll be some rocks, but you just roll around them.
And what is the best and worst advice you have received?
Best advice, do what you love because you'll be good at it. That's super. I'll give it a more tactical one. Really great advice I got is you get what you measure. So for any operators out there setting up businesses, you get what you measure. I think it's a great, great one. The worst advice for me personally, but not the worst advice at all. You know, I was kind of told, look, just do this law thing for 2 years, get it on your CV. And then once you've got it on your CV, you know, you can do what you want. I don't think that's bad advice whatsoever. I think that's very valid advice for a lot of people. But for me personally, it was bad advice because, you know, I think one, time is everything. So just do not waste time. I was wasting time. So that was why I was, and I knew I had to do something else. But yeah, that was personally not great advice, but I don't blame the advice giver.
Our common friend, Gabriel, just told me you have just launched a music album. I've listened actually to one song and I mean, it's pretty impressive. Were you always jamming? Would you like to sing something for us?
I'm not going to sing something on the podcast, but
I know
because I haven't had a beer. It's the sparkling water is definitely not enough confidence. No, that's extremely kind. The story behind it, I hit 30 and I was like, you know what? The only regret I have is that I never pursued music properly because actually, despite everything I've just told you about startups and starting companies and all that kind of stuff, the thing I love the most, the thing I'm the most passionate about creating is music. I've always kind of played, but never really taken it seriously. But turned 30 and I was like, you know what? I'm going to get one song on Spotify. That's my goal for myself. And so I just started writing, started speaking to a couple of friends and they introduced me to some music producers. And thank you, Napa. Shout out to Napa from One House and the Wayward guys who helped me produce the album. And then basically, yeah, produced... ended up producing a whole EP, ended up getting signed by a small label, which is an awesome label, a guy called Nick who runs Aperion. And yeah, just been releasing it kind of as we speak. It's now on Spotify and it's like, honestly, it's a dream come true. So I'm the most proud of that because it was the hardest thing for me to do because I was a complete amateur and it was extremely scary. So thank you for listening and bringing it up. It's been awesome.
Amazing. So I guess like that's why you said do what you love, like the advice, and then you kind of change to being a little bit more practical.
Yeah, do what you love, 100%. Because if you do what you love, it will never feel like a job.
And if we would have to end this podcast on a song, which song would you like us to end with?
One of my songs or just a general song?
No. Yeah. So should we end like with Coastlines or which song would you like? I've listened a little bit to Gone Acoustic and then Coastlines.
Yeah, nice.
Which song do you think would be a good fit?
I love that. Man, I need all the streams I can get. So I massively appreciate that. I'd say Coastlines just because it's the most popular and it's a bit more like upbeat. So Coastlines is probably the one to go with.
Coastlines it is.
The coastline. Oh, baby, I remember the day you were crying in autumn's rain. It all was us
And if Xavier from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell him?
Oh man, that's hard. Enjoy
Publish
it.
Publish that album.
Stop music earlier. No. Buy shares in Google or something. I'd say, you know, enjoy it. Nothing good happens in your comfort zone. Nothing good happens in your comfort zone. So push yourself and enjoy it.
Amazing. Xavier, thank you so much for taking the time.
No worries.
This was a blast.
Awesome. Hey, thank you so much. It was great to be here.